Hi, this is Melly.
Hey, Melly, how are you? This is Bill Hoag.
Oh, hi, Bill. How are you?
I'm doing very well. So why don't we get started? The way we've generally started is to ask our respondents to spend a few minutes reflecting on their own career progression, giving a little summary of the stops that you've made and what roles you've played at each stop. Maybe if you would, you could start there by just giving us a recap of your career thus far.
Well, my background is in psychology, and I'm originally from the Philippines. I first came to this country on a fellowship in psychology at Northwestern, so IT is a diversion from that field. So I started my IT career quite by accident, actually, as a programmer analyst for a school of business in Ohio. And the goal was to integrate technology into the curriculum. And what got me hired for that position was the prior teaching experience, which they needed, you know, faculty experience desired. And believe it or not, tinkering with a Heathkit processor, microprocessor, this was before PCs and microcomputers were deployed in great numbers. So that qualified me both from a technology and a faculty experience, but it was really an accidental overture into information technology, and that's how I got started with IT. Teaching in psychology at the University of the Philippines and doing research in verbal learning, psycholinguistics, social psych, experimental design, that was my background. And over the years doing IT, I became very interested in how, you know, the learning aspect and the communication aspect of what we do, and I felt that my psychology background had some relevance in how you help people use computers. So user support became an area of interest as well. This is my third CIO ship. I can't say that I said very early on, what would I do? What should I do to become a CIO? I really didn't do that.
One of the things that I notice from your profile on the EDUCAUSE site is that at the University of Rochester, you were the first CIO for that institution.
Yes.
Since you have been a CIO at, this is your third institution, is that right?
That's correct.
A CIO?
Yes.
Anything that you would say that are things that you've learned about private universities versus public universities, relatively large universities versus smaller universities, anything, again, keeping in mind our audience of up-and-coming leaders in higher education, IT, anything that you would observe from those moves that might be useful information for that group?
Yeah, I really truly enjoyed my tenure at the University of Arizona. It's a large public university. The usual constraints of public funding and satisfying a diverse and large constituency. One of the things that I thought was easier to do in a public university is you're able to demonstrate economies of scale much more easily than in a private university, which may be very small, very targeted. And while both public and private universities are very highly decentralized, seeking, you know, critical mass in a small private university may be a bit of a challenge, but it can be done. In both public and private universities, I found that a big, huge role that a CIO does is really communicating and coordinating action across the various groups. As a first CIO in Rochester, I know that one of my first challenges was truly to bring the groups together who had never worked together, were rewarded separately, following their own culture and rules. So I frequently refer to my first staff meeting where I invited the provost, whom they had not seen before, as a come-to-Jesus meeting and introducing the various groups to each other. So building an organization and unifying an organization, and pretty much it's the standard, you know, how do you build a solid team? They have to have the commitment to become a team, have the competence to pull things together. We had to communicate. And very, very importantly, we had to have the common goals. I think that's true for both public and private universities, though the constituencies and the rules of engagement may differ. Private universities have probably more latitude and freedom in terms of procedures and processes, and certainly, as you both have experienced, the rules of sharing information are different in a private and a public university. Freedom for information filings that you would get in a public university would be very different from a private university. How you deal with the media in a private university versus public, those are very different kinds of rules. But in both cases, relationship building is very important. Cost management are very important. Is very important, though. There is definitely a lot more public scrutiny and reviews that you would have to be very patient with in a public institution. Those are thoughts that come to mind. I can think more about that. At one time, a colleague of mine in Rochester and I wrote down, you know, differences between private and public universities. He had just come from Michigan and I came from Arizona, and here we were in Rochester making sense of IT, where we were never in the same organization, and making coherent and cohesive our goals was the challenge.
Billy, what about the size of the institution? How would you talk about that? What kind of wisdom would you give to someone in terms of considerations for choosing a place to work by the size of the institution, based on your experience and what's been the challenge versus the fulfillment?
Certainly in terms of size, the contrast of experience from being in Arizona serving 50,000 people to Rochester, whose goal was to make it smaller even. It was 4,500 students wanting to make it go lower to 3,500 and picking the best. So in terms of communication, the challenges that you will have in a larger university is certainly higher in terms of the amount of communication, the different mechanisms of communication you'll need to engage in, and how you empower and enable and engage people to communicate on your behalf would be larger in a public university. In a private university with a small size, word would travel very fast, so caution in communication of issues and problems and how you manage that would be something to consider. It's certainly much easier to get to know all the players in a small university. One of the things I thought I would do in Rochester and find in Rochester is finally, you know, it's a small size. I can truly see how IT affects the classroom and how to work more closely with faculty. And that's certainly easier to do with a smaller size population. But it's more than just size, of course. It's also the culture, the collegiality. Like my experience here in Tufts is the community building and the kind of the culture of collegiality across schools is so it's a little, it's different from Rochester. It's a very, very friendly place and likes to interact a lot with each other. So size in any organization could facilitate the relationship building that we all need to do in IT.
But you haven't found there to be an element of scale to the difficulty. It's not a one-for-one relationship of the scale for the difficulty, the size for the difficulty of the job.
I didn't find that to be a source of difficulty, though I know that it may have been the direction. I know I have colleagues who spent more years in a private institution and went to a public institution, and there was complete shock in terms of, you know, the rules, the number of people, the complexity. And I went the other way, where I was used to the size and complexity And yeah, I mentioned earlier that, you know, economies of scale is harder to demonstrate, you know, site licensing coordination in a large public institution would have a lot more impact than in a small institution that cannot get all the volume discount, for instance, on a very mundane dimension. That's one difference.
Millie, when you reflect back on your time in particular in Arizona as you were building your career towards your first CIO position, were there any particular moments during your career when you said, gee, I think I could be a CIO, or turning points that may be related to projects that you were involved with or major initiatives, any kind of people who may have influenced you in that direction? Were there any of those gestalt moments when the light bulb went on, or was it more something that you evolved toward?
It's probably both, because I was in Arizona for 17 years, and in all those 17 years, I moved around because there was always something to do. There was a new project, so I was recruited to move around, and probably that prepared me to be a CIO, working from the help desk to telecommunications and in all of the areas, in academic computing. So I went around for a tour of duty, always being tapped for problem solving for particular projects. So that helped prepare me, but I really, really like to learn. So learning in a new project or a new job was very enjoyable for me as I was developing as an IT professional then. In terms of moving up to leadership, so there was a progressive advancement, if you will, when you become a manager and they ask you to be assistant director and director. But where the big opportunity came was when we had a huge undertaking in Arizona where the president of the university explored outsourcing all of IT to a third party. So that organizational, quote, threat was a big wake-up call for the entire organization. And while I was in a director role at that time, and there was, you know, our VP left, we all worked together engaging, realizing that we needed to engage the campus in a different way. We knew we had to engage the administration in a different way. We knew we couldn't fight or brute force ourselves and be negative toward the third-party reviewers that were brought in for the outsourcing. So managing all of that as a team of directors, that was when I was tapped by the administration for temporary leadership of the group, because we were all going through this organizational turmoil of how to respond to the university opportunity to look at leapfrogging to the future with the help of a third party, and how to engage the staff in making sure that we demonstrate that we can step up and respond to this challenge. And so making an offer to the administration that we are willing to help them review this opportunity and invite them to look to us as partners in reviewing IT with the benefit of the institution in mind. So that was probably the moment where I emerged as the leader and was asked to continue on while the review was going on. And eventually, I was asked to serve as the vice provost. So it was in response to a very, you know, major change initiative led by the president and the cabinet at that time.
So my question of you from the perspective of a CIO at three different institutions is, what do you do at a personal level and a professional level to cope with disappointments, to cope with frustrations, to navigate through turbulent waters? All of us face those sorts of things sometimes on a daily basis.
Yeah.
And yet we're asked to maintain our poise and to be good leaders, be a voice of rationality, even if other voices are not so rational. And so my question is, what strategies might you recommend to people who have the need to navigate through those kinds of turbulent times?
Well, having colleagues to network with, and over the years, I've had the opportunity to develop very good relationships with colleagues who have come to know me, and staying centered and not taking things personally, because our job is very complicated, very hard to satisfy all the constituencies. We really, CIOs in higher education really face a much more difficult CIO-ship than we used to have a monthly meeting with CIOs in big corporations in Rochester, and they acknowledge that because the constituencies we serve require different types of handling and different rules of engagement. You know, the students, what students demand and what faculty prefer to be dealt with and what administration expects from us. You're right, it's really an interplay of very complex and very frustrating demands and pressures and expectations. So really knowing yourself, I guess, that infamous tired saying, knowing yourself is very important, and that there are things you cannot change, knowing what you can influence and control. And it's I always come back to the question of, you know, what is the issue, what is the problem, what are the alternatives, and how do you go about doing it. It's helped me greatly to have not just informal colleagues, but educause using existing mechanisms and sources of advice. I like reading books, so sometimes, even if there are not many, many new ideas on leadership, sometimes it's just picking up an old book or a new one that can speak to lowering your blood pressure about some issues that are pressing. So it's a multitude of things. I am bad at vacations, but I'm trying to do better this time. I think that's one other thing one needs to do is know when to go to the balcony and not be on the dance floor. And this is true even while not on vacation, where you sometimes have to step back and assess and think. Scheduling think time is now something I am appreciating and doing, versus, you know, we are all pushed to plunge into action and not step back. So I'm doing a lot more stepping back, also engaging more people rather than putting everything on your shoulders. So that's one other tactic I do. I read a lot, comparing notes. In Rochester, in New York, we had NYSERNet. We have all the CIOs from various universities comparing notes, and I think that has a very high value. I know you and David and several others have been looking at career development and culling nuggets of wisdom. Those are very helpful sources. So,
Mel, given how hard you have articulated perfectly how difficult this job is, so let me just ask you a question that an aspiring leader might ask you. Why do you do it?
You learn something new every time. It's learning. And you can make a difference. And there is a very rewarding feeling about learning and making a difference. That's why I do it. It's not the technologies. It's the relationships you make. If you can have someone understand something that they thought was so difficult, that's a pleasure.
That's a great answer. Let me ask you a question that I've reflected on knowing that we were going to talk to you today, and I think you may be unusually qualified for this question.
What is that?
I think you'll know why when I ask it. I hope you don't mind me asking it. But, you know, you bring a certain perspective to this that would be so valuable to a number of people. And the question is this. Melly, you are a young, female, minority that has done extremely well, welcoming diverse views of higher education notwithstanding. That's a heck of an achievement for you to be where you are today.
Well, thank you.
You know, and we hear about the glass ceiling and things many times that you can't break through. If someone said to you, given those sorts of parameters that you've worked with, Millie, how did you do it? What's your key to success?
I grew up in a family of 12, six boys, six girls. And very early on, I learned what it's like to be collaborative because you have to divide things 12 ways. And you have to compete for the attention of your parents. And it seemed like equality of the sexes was one of the things that we never talked about, but it was there. So I think over the years as I was doing this, it was always there was something needing to be done, and you just do it regardless of, you know, you don't know it. When I was asked to join, for instance, telecommunications in Arizona, I said, I can't do it because I don't know telecommunications. I could certainly try to learn, and I picked up all what I could get from, you know, the telecommunications associations, the ABCs of telecom. And, you know, in time you begin to discover that it's just a new language. You know, DID, you know, dial inward dialing, that's nothing so very intimidating when you talk about T-lines and DSL. They're just lines and they're just pathways. So I guess part of it is understanding that there are always new contexts and new languages to learn, and the willingness to do that and to learn it, and not ever realizing you've mastered it, keeps you motivated to keep learning. So I think the learning part is one of the things that I thrive on. I think I mentioned that earlier, and as you asked this, I'm thinking, you know, what is it? When I came to this country, I thought, you know, I'd be lucky if I will be hired to flip hamburgers, because I felt that I had no identity and no background, and I was very lucky when I came to Northwestern that there was a professor who told me that I should learn to speak, because I wouldn't speak in the classroom. I learned English in the classroom, I can write it, but socially I could not easily do it. So his prodding to say this is going to be so very important really convinced me that I always have to learn, and it can be learned if you put your mind to it. It doesn't sound simple, but it was simple as that, you know. If you learn it, you can do it. If you don't do well, maybe it's not a match to your talent.
Well, Millie, when you talked about your first leadership position, it was where you were facing outsourcing, and I think you came into the position as kind of a natural consensus from others that you were a leader of choice, if I'm saying that correctly. What is it that makes a good leader? Why did folks look at you as this is the person who, in the best of senses, you know, they determined this is someone that we would follow?
Well, part of it is understanding, in that particular case in Arizona, understanding what the university was trying to do, what the president was trying to do. At the same time, understanding what the organization was going through and trying to bridge and find the path by which you could say that we both want the same thing. So I wanted, as a member of the IT organization, for us to succeed and to deliver the services that the university wanted. The university, the president, wanted to leapfrog to the future and make IT be part of the strategic advancement of the university. It required engaging ourselves in a different way. It required accepting that we needed to move to a different level of success. It's accepting that change was needed. It's accepting that the status quo was not going to be adequate for the future. It's really a commitment to alter the future and a decision that we can do it. But with that bigger and broader vision of the university moving forward, it's that North Star, if you will, it's that we need to move forward. We can't do it without each other. That's a very important truth to embrace. Even if the university, the president wanted to consider outsourcing, we had to accept that as an opportunity. Just as the third party, I told them, could examine us, let us help you examine the third party. So it's that bringing together and the willingness to explore it in a way that's positive and constructive, which was very hard because the tensions were very high, the morale was so low, people were saying, you're selling us out to the enemy. It was that, you know, pulling people together, and a part of that was discovering, you know, not everybody will get it all at once, but we discovered some people were now willing to help in the organization. It used to be we weren't allowed in the cabinet meetings, and so when I was invited, I brought along people who wanted to help, and there were 7 of us, then there were 14 of us, and then before you know it, there were faculty members volunteering to help us. So it's that building of the coalition that helped the organization to move forward. So it's not a one-person job. It's really having that intention and mobilizing those who are willing to help. And just continuously improving and checking in all the time how we're doing.
There is one natural follow-up question to what you've just said, Melly, and this is a great question based on 2 things you said, Melly. One was how much you learned from the family environment you grew up in, and the other was that you've referred to as how much you learned from going through a very difficult and challenging situation. So the follow-up question then is, in your mind, how much of leadership is learned and versus how much of it is just someone's born with it?
Well, I think we learn a lot of the leadership. Leadership development, you know, is, I notice it among the staff, you know, you can create an environment where that is fostered and different people will take to it differently. But I think it's once people engage and try it and succeed, so how to help others succeed is part of the trick. And having a taste of it is something that I think you can learn. Also accepting that it's going to be up to you. When I first came here and I got married, I was expecting my husband to help me out. But in the end, you know, it was very clear to me that he too was introverted like me, and there was no way. I had to learn it on my own. And when I was in Rochester, part of what drove this home to me, I think you had a question, if I recall, you know, do you have a mantra that really sticks? And in Rochester, it was very clear to me, Rochester has this saying, it's Greek for always better, it's meliora is the term, that it's truly what one could internalize as an organization. And we kept using it in my organization, meliora always better, meliora always better, to the point that before I left or at the time, people were giving me meliora frames or meliora things, but with M-E-L-Y as the, because I just was nagging them too much about it. So is that, you know, effective teaching or is that learning? I think there's quite a bit of learning there. But expectation setting and stretch goals that you give the organization is part of it, too. So we can, as CIOs, as you have done, create contexts where people are engaged to, and they say, you know, you have to set the bar higher than what you want so that the stretch could be, the stretch goal is there. Also, it's good to be in unfamiliar situations that's part of learning. Traveling does that for you. I have a 15-year-old, and part of how he is learning is just new experiences coming to Boston. You know, I didn't know how to drive until I was an adult coming here, and if you don't drive in this country, you can't go anywhere. So there's no choice. You have to learn to drive. It was just frightening. To this day, I can say I'm not a comfortable driver. I drive every day, but that's learning. That's not, you know, built in, but that's a scientific question. That's an empirical question. How much of it is wired? How much of it is in your DNA? How much of it is learned?
Okay, well, I appreciate your answer.
Melly, a little bit earlier in the conversation, you referenced a faculty member at Northwestern who was very encouraging to you to be more actively engaged in classroom and laboratory and social settings, to trust your instincts, to trust your intelligence, to trust your capabilities, and to have the confidence to put yourself forward. And that sounds like something a mentor would say. Whether you describe that particular faculty member as a mentor or not, are there mentors who've been of significant importance during the course of your career?
Well, everywhere I worked, you know, there was always the opportunity to seek guidance from people around you. I've always tried to work very well with my bosses, which means getting to know them and the differences that we all have, and having them know you and what strengths and weaknesses you have. So I think I've been fortunate in having mentors all along, like the professor in Northwestern was my sponsor for the fellowship, had read materials I had written, but written in my language, and he forced me to translate it to him as a way of making me feel comfortable. He knew my English was fine, otherwise I couldn't have gotten the fellowships and I couldn't have gotten the A's in his classes, but I wouldn't speak because, as I was telling him, as I begin to speak, you know, and my question is in chapter 1, the whole class is already in chapter 10. It was just, I lacked practice. So that's what he did. He said, you know, you're welcome to come to my office, use my secretary, converse with her, use my library. I didn't realize he was kind of considered a big guy. He was the president of American Psychological Association. People were scared of him. And here I was hanging out in his office. So, yeah, I think that gave me, you know, my first feel of what mentorship is, in at least in this country. In the Philippines, you know, I was encouraged by our department chair, who was the one who nominated me for the fellowship. So even in IT, you know, I remember my first SNOMAS meeting, and I didn't know anybody, and Jacqueline Brown, who was then at Princeton, said, "You're new here. Let me introduce you." While she didn't really mentor me, I tell that story all the time, and Jacqueline says, "Don't ever tell that story again," but she introduced me to people who I became comfortable in approaching. Without the introduction, I probably won't know them today. So over time, that has become easier, but it's with the help of a lot of people and in my circles within the universities that I've worked in. I would consider working with your senior administration as very important, and that I consider part of what I need to learn from a coaching standpoint. And also over time, I've come to get to know people in EDUCAUSE. When I taught at the EDUCAUSE Leadership Institute, your faculty peers become your sounding boards. In Rochester, the group of CIOs from Kodak and Bausch & Lomb decided, you know, we all liked each other, and we would have monthly dinners that rotate in location and sponsorship. That was a very good source of, again, feedback and sounding board. Being on the EDUCAUSE board exposed me to a lot of very intelligent people and leaders in the field that just gave you the opening to to learn with them or to just listen to them. Brian Hawkins has been very interested in writing about career development, and so when I read his articles and ask questions, those are all very useful information. His presentation on how to sit at the big table is something I share with everyone, too.
The wrap-up question that David and I typically pose is there anything on your mind that we didn't think about asking that you think we probably should have?
Probably related to that, just one last comment. Starting a CIO job and starting over and learning from each other and truly, as I already said, accelerating progress in a way that's effective and synchronized with the new culture, which is a very complicated way of saying you have to learn the new culture and they expect you to bring something to it. How do you do that discovery in a way that organizes your thinking and planning and charting the course of action for the new CIO-ship? The audiences that we are going to be dealing with are aspiring CIOs, like for our session. That's a question that I have received before. So I'm thinking about that and jotting down some thoughts on startup phases and how do you learn, how do you orient, how do you immerse, how do you consolidate, how do you refine? You know, what's that process of gaining traction when you're the newcomer?
Millie, it's been a real pleasure.
Well, yeah.
Thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome. It's great talking with you, and good luck with the book.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.